Lee and his army occupy a central position in the history of the Confederacy and, in a broader sense, in the history of the Civil War. Civilian morale depended on, in large measure, both in the United States and in the Confederacy, on the activities of the armies in the field. Civilians very eagerly followed the activities of the armies. They got most of their information from newspapers. They either subscribed to them or they passed them around. Newspapers, the principal source of information. But they also got a lot of information from letters written home by soldiers in the armies. And as they received this information and as they processed it, morale went up and down. Very big shifts of morale in fairly short times often. There's a sense on the part of many people that morale was linear during the Civil War. People often begin their consideration of the conflict at Appomattox with knowledge of United States victory, and they work backward from that point trying to find what went wrong with the Confederate war effort. And there's a sense from that approach to the war that there is a pretty straight line going from the beginning of the war to Appomattox, with morale declining on the Confederate side and rising on the side of the United States. That simply wasn't the case. There are great shifts of morale, many spikes on both sides, almost always in direct response to what people are learning about the activities of their respective armies on the battlefield. It's always a mistake to begin at the end of a story, of any historical story, and read backward trying to understand what went on. It's far more important to read forward through the story. And in terms of the impact of the armies and military events on civilian morale, that is especially important during the Civil War. You have to follow events forward and see how the people on each side reacted to the unfolding news. Civilian expectations in these two democracies at war often affected military planning, could affect the choice of commanders. Both Abraham Lincoln and Jefferson Davis appointed a number of political figures to generalships because it served certain constituencies. Lincoln appointed Nathaniel P. Banks and John C. Fremont and Benjamin Franklin Butler and others, not because he thought they were great generals, but because he was serving constituencies behind the lines. Jefferson Davis did the same thing in Robert E. Lee's army. Two prominent Georgia politicians, Robert Toombs and Howell Cobb, held positions as general officers because of their political importance, not because of their military gifts. The civilian expectations also could affect strategic planning. Early on, the Confederacy followed what some historians have called a cordon defense, that is, trying to defend every part of the Confederate national territory because the people demanded it. The people in Arkansas wanted Confederate forces protecting them. So did the people in Virginia. So did the people in every other Confederate state. And at first, the government tried to do that. In the end, or long before the end, Davis and his advisors realized that they couldn't protect everything, and they shifted to a strategic posture that is often called either the offensive-defensive or the defensive-offensive, which consisted of congregating the bulk of national military resources in large field armies and having them try to protect certain areas, mobile field armies that would meet major United States threats. Don't defend every place. Concentrate your resources. Stand on the broad defensive, but try to find moments at which to launch counterblows against the United States forces that were making their way into the South. But civilian expectations played a role here, too, in this strategic planning. Now, much of the writing about the Civil War does not focus on these connections between the home front and the battlefield. There's a great divide in much Civil War writing, which tends to either focus entirely on military topics or to focus entirely on civilian topics. Academic historians tend not to be interested in military affairs, so they write about the non-military dimensions of the war. Non-academic historians tend to focus on the military dimensions of the war, and they have created a great literature in terms of its size on the individual campaigns and generals and how officers reacted on different battlefields. They've looked at the tactical minutiae of almost every major and many minor battles during the Civil War. But these two parts of the literature often don't intersect in any significant way, which is a mistake, because in order to understand the war, in order to understand how it unfolded and why it unfolded the way it did, we have to understand the reciprocal influences between the home front and the battlefield. And Lee's army is a perfect vehicle for us to try to understand that. All of the ways in which what happened on the military front influenced events behind the lines and vice versa. As I said earlier, no military force on either side wielded greater influence in this regard than Lee and the Army of Northern Virginia. Lee's army was the only Confederate force that ever really won victories. The story of Confederate military affairs, except for Lee and his army, is largely a story of failure. Out in the Western Theater, the great theater between the Appalachian Mountains and the Mississippi River and beyond, is a theater where almost nothing good happens for the Confederacy. All the great battles in the West, with one exception, the Battle of Chickamauga in September 1863, all the other great battles were failures for the Confederacy. The whole strategic landscape, in many ways, is filled with failure for the Confederacy, except for events in Virginia, the Virginia, Maryland, Pennsylvania theater where Lee and his army operated. That is where the Confederate people could find some good news. Much of the rest of the story of the war was negative for the Confederates. So they tended to focus on Lee and his army. They tended to look to where the good news was coming from, and they came to invest more of their emotional capital in the army that gave them victories than in the armies that did not give them victories. On the other side of the Potomac River, citizens of the United States understandably saw Lee and his army as the greatest threat to restoration of the Union. This is the army that's defeating United States forces, especially the most famous and largest of the United States armies, the Army of the Potomac.